Hello, folks. Welcome to the LRIS podcast series. My name is Will Aitchison, and this is going to be another one in our hopefully short series on the labor and employment implications in the public safety workplace of COVID-19. I have four things I want to talk to you about today. All four of them are sort of in the way of updates, but there have been some significant developments. So the first thing I want to talk about is the status of COVID-19 presumptive causation laws for workers' comp purposes. I then want to talk about hazardous duty pay, what we're seeing with regard to that. Third thing is, what's been the impact so far that we've seen of COVID-19 on the collective bargaining process? What sorts of deals are being cut out there by public safety unions and the public safety employers with which they deal? And then the fourth thing is going to be a law enforcement specific development. We continue to have law enforcement officers around the country who are drawing a line in the sand and who are saying, I'm not going to enforce this emergency order of the governor, whatever this might be. It could be people being required to wear masks or people being required to stay at home. And I want to talk about in a little bit more detail this time what the legal framework is of that issue. Okay, so let's talk first about presumptive causation laws. It's been a month since I've spoken to you about these, and we've seen some changes, but unfortunately, not a lot. And it's safe to say that right now, the majority of states in this country do not have presumptive causation rules. Let's reset. What's a presumptive causation rule? It's a rule of workers' compensation law that if you encounter a certain condition, these are almost always diseases, that it is presumed that that disease was caused by the job. It's only a presumption. The employer can overcome the presumption by proving that the disease or the condition was caused by off-the-job factors. But presumptive causations really give employees a leg up with respect to establishing workers' compensation claims. And when I say a leg up, when you have a presumptive causation law, it's almost impossible for an employer to prove that the condition was not caused by the job. So for example, there are cases, I see them every month, and we only put a few of them in our newsletter. I only rarely talk about them on the podcast, the First Thursday podcast, but there are cases out there all the time involving firefighters, and firefighters have a much richer set of presumptive causation laws around the country. So most of these cases are firefighter cases. So you see these cases where you have a firefighter who's had a heart attack and has filed a workers' compensation claim. And the employer brings evidence into the workers' compensation hearing where the employer is saying, well, yeah, he did have a heart attack, but on the other hand, he was a two-pack-a-day smoker for 30 years. He also had a high level of cholesterol, and he was basically a heart attack waiting to happen. Didn't exercise, was morbidly obese, you know, whatever the constellation of factors might be. And you'll see the workers' compensation agency saying to the employer, yeah, but you didn't prove that it wasn't caused by the job. Now, sometimes employers can prevail in those types of cases, but not often. And the result is that presumptive causation laws are expensive. You'll hear me talk in a couple of minutes about what's going on in California. The estimate is that the COVID-19 presumption in California is going to cost the state $1 billion, cost employers in the state $1 billion. So these things are expensive. Employers typically have resisted them, and employees, of course, want them. And we're seeing that debate played out in state legislatures around the country. So where are the COVID-19 presumptive causation laws around the country? And I'm just going to go in alphabetical order here. It's not going to be too long a list, but I want to talk about how some of these presumptions came into existence, because there's some not small amount of controversy about that. So let's start with Alaska. There's none in Alabama, by the way. Let's talk about in Alaska. In Alaska, Alaska was an early adopter here. April 10th, Governor Mike Dunleavy signed into law something that is known as Senate Bill 241, and it contains a conclusive presumption that a first responder who contracts COVID-19 after an on-the-job exposure got the disease as a result of an on-the-job exposure. Notice I stressed the phrase conclusive presumption. A conclusive presumption cannot be rebutted. So that means in Alaska, if you're a first responder, and who's a first responder? Firefighter, paramedic, EMT, peace officer, healthcare provider. If you are a first responder and you get COVID-19 on the job, all you have to do is prove that you had an on-the-job exposure to the disease, and boom, that is a workers' compensation covered condition. That's the strongest presumption that is out there, really in the country, is the one that's in place in Alaska right now. Arizona, there's no presumptive causation in Arizona. On May 14th, so just about a week ago or so, something known as the Industrial Commission in Arizona, that's part of the workers' compensation system there, issued what it called an advisory statement. What was the advisory statement? Employers, and I'm quoting, may not categorically deny COVID-19 claims, end of quote. Really? That's the best you can do if you're going to be talking about presumptive causation? You come up with a rule that employers may not categorically deny COVID-19 claims? Well, that's not going to get employees very far at all. And my understanding is that the push for presumptive causation continues in Arizona. Arkansas, on April 14th, the governor, nothing was passed in the legislature in Arkansas, the governor issued an order allowing first responders and healthcare workers to be eligible for workers' comp, now listen carefully, but only if they can demonstrate a causal connection between their diagnosis and exposure to COVID-19 as a result of their employment. That's no presumptive causation at all, right? It requires the employee to show that the exposure caused the condition. And just like a presumptive causation law is very difficult for an employer to overcome, employees pretty much can never show that exposure to a disease caused their condition. Why is that? Because there's so many other places you can be exposed to the same disease, right? So if I were a first responder in Arkansas, I'd look at Governor Asa Hutchinson and say, geez, thanks a lot, guy. You did absolutely nothing for us. Okay, what about California? California, we have another executive order from a governor. In this case, it's Governor Gavin Newsom, and he issued an executive order that creates a presumption that COVID-19 incurred by frontline workers is caused by the job. Now, this presumption is going to expire on July 5th. The California legislature has several bills, the most prominent of which is known as Assembly Bill 664, pending that would make the presumptive causation continue into the future. But I want to talk about the fact that this was done by executive order, because in some places, governors are getting tired of looking at legislatures just simply waiting around or debating or not meeting or doing or not doing whatever they're doing or not doing, and they are issuing these sorts of executive orders. Are they legal? Maybe. There hasn't been much of a challenge to them anywhere. When we get to Illinois, I'll talk about a very different type of challenge that was filed with respect to an executive order there. But the sort of thing that Governor Newsom has done to issue this executive order, I have not seen that challenged in court. Now, Governor Newsom's executive order, far more expansive than what went on, for example, in Alaska. It's more expansive in the sense that it applies to all frontline workers. So not just first responders and medical personnel, but everybody who's out there who's, you know, basically bagging groceries or doing whatever it is they're doing to keep the rest of us from all sorts of different types of dire conditions. All right, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, District of Columbia, nothing is going on, no presumptive causation. In Florida, on April 1, the chief financial officer for the state of Florida issued a directive. It only applies to state employees, and the directive is optional. The state agencies can either choose to follow it or not follow it. If they follow it, it creates a presumptive causation. The Florida League of Cities, which runs a workers' comp insurance trust that covers many cities and counties, remember what the state did, only applies to state employees. The League of Cities in Florida sent a letter to the state of Florida saying it would apply a presumptive causation rule for COVID-19 for the purposes of workers' comp claims by first responders. But that's one insurance trust among many. And to the best of my knowledge, there's nothing going on in the Florida legislature. By the way, I have a table of all this. Guess what? I don't have it memorized. I got a table, and we are going to put the table online on our website so you'll be able to download it. Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho has not seen anything. Then we get to Illinois. In Illinois, on April 13th, the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission announced an emergency amendment to its rules of evidence. These are the rules as to what's admissible and not admissible in a workers' compensation hearing. And this rule announced that if a first responder or a frontline worker was diagnosed with COVID-19 during the state of emergency, that it was presumed that the virus was caused by the job. So effectively what it did was to shift the burden of proof to employers to show off-the-job causation. Very quickly, a group of employers, including the Illinois Municipal League, so this includes public sector employers, challenged the commission's decision. They obtained a temporary restraining order blocking the rules, and the commission has withdrawn the rules. There's now a bill that's been introduced in the Illinois legislature, but as of now, no presumptive causation. Told you I'd tell you the legal theory that was used in Illinois by the Municipal League. And it didn't have anything to do with the authority of the Workers' Compensation Commission to announce this rule, but rather the process by which it did. All states have something called an Administrative Procedures Act that requires them to follow certain processes before they make rule changes. And the court found here that the Administrative Procedures Act was violated by the enactment of this emergency rule. Now, could the state have defended that up the chain of the court system? Maybe. You know, the Municipal League did what you would expect anybody who is trying to challenge something that is on a statewide basis to do, and that is it cherry-picked where it filed the lawsuit. It filed it in an extremely conservative county in downstate Illinois. Reports were they got an extremely conservative judge. Could the state, the Workers' Compensation Commission, have appealed that to the much more workers-friendly Illinois Court of Appeals? Maybe, but they didn't. And so now it's going to come down to what the legislature does. Indiana, Iowa, nothing going on. No presumptive causation. Kansas, interesting story. There were bills that were introduced in the Kansas legislature, or at least being discussed, not introduced, in the Kansas legislature. And then finally, on April 20th, the governor, Laura Kelly, said, you know what? Enough is enough. And she directed the Kansas Department of Labor, she's the executive for the Department of Labor, to develop a regulation that would create a presumption that first responders and healthcare workers contracted COVID-19 on the job if they were able to show that they were exposed to the condition. Kentucky, we have another governor acting all on his own, Governor Andy Beshear, on April 9th, another early adopter here. He simply announced an emergency order that removal from work by a physician, removal from work of a first responder for COVID-19 was related to the job. Nothing in Louisiana, nothing in Maine, nothing in Maryland. Massachusetts, there are bills pending in the legislature. And the Massachusetts Municipal League has weighed in opposing the legislation. And it's taking the position, and I'm quoting, "The solution is to require existing health plans to pay for all medical costs and to create fully paid COVID-19 hazard duty leave for all first responders, preserving their regular earned sick leave balances." I find that position to be a mystery for a municipal league to take. Municipal leagues made up of a bunch of cities. And what they're saying here is, you know, there's two aspects to a workers' comp claim. There's the medical costs, and then there's the leave. What do you do? How do you account for the leave when the employee is away from work? And the what the Municipal League is saying is our existing healthcare systems in cities should pay for the medical costs, and the leave, that should be something where the legislature mandates fully paid COVID-19 hazardous duty leave, which also would be paid by the cities and counties. So where are the savings beyond presumptive causation? And if you think it through, the savings are in a kind of a deep, dark place, because there's a third element to workers' compensation laws, and that is if someone is permanently disabled, you can receive benefits for the rest of your life under workers' compensation systems, or if you die as a result of an on-the-job injury or illness, your spouse, your family will receive a workers' compensation award. What the Municipal League is really saying here is, look, we don't mind picking up the medical costs. We'll do that through our insurance. We don't mind paying for the leave. We'll do that through just normal budgeting for leave. But we don't want to pay for permanent total disability costs or death benefits. Michigan. We have another governor acting unilaterally, and she acted very early, March 18th. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, in conjunction with what's known as the Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity, issued rules creating an irrebuttable presumption that COVID-19 was caused by the job if, and there are four possible conditions. The employee is quarantined due to COVID-19 exposure. The employee receives a COVID-19 diagnosis from a physician. Third, receives a presumptive positive COVID-19 test, or, not and, you don't have to meet all of these, receives a laboratory-confirmed COVID-19 diagnosis. So this is along the lines of what Alaska did, a little bit more detailed, but it's pretty much a conclusive presumption. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't think what Governor Whitmer did there has been challenged. All right, next up, Minnesota. Another governor acting. On April 14th, Governor Tim Walz signed this is a legislative action. The governor signed a bill, it's known as Bill Number 4537, that established a presumptive causation for emergency first responders and frontline workers, unless the employer can prove the infection happened elsewhere. Good luck for the employers on that. Mississippi, of course, no presumptive causation. Missouri, you have governor action again. Governor Mike Parson issued an executive order that is applicable for the duration of the COVID-19 emergency, and it creates a presumptive causation rule that can only be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. So not quite a conclusive presumption, but more than the usual amount of proof is necessary. More than a preponderance of the evidence, this has to be clear and convincing evidence. Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, no legislative action, no presumptive causation. New Hampshire, there is, a governor's action, April 24th, a prima facie presumption decreed Governor Christopher Sununu that a first responder's COVID-19 exposure and infection were occupationally related. Now, this executive order remains in place only for the duration of the declared emergency. And that's somewhat troubling from the employee standpoint, if you think about it, right? Isn't it possible that the declared emergency could end so the governor says no more emergency condition could end before the workers' compensation claims are being filed for certain employees? Maybe. And that might mean that they are out of luck unless there's some sort of cleanup legislation. New Jersey, nothing has happened. President of the Senate there has announced support for a first responder presumptive causation, but we haven't seen it yet. New Mexico, another governor acting. The governor wrote the Workers' Compensation Commission on April 13th. This is Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, and she urged the commission to afford first responders, medical personnel, and other employees who worked at COVID-19 specific care centers, as well as, and I'm reading from her order, those whose work brings them into repeated and direct personal contact with those suffering from COVID-19, she ordered the Workers' Compensation Commission to treat them as having a presumptive causation. New York, nothing is going on. There's some bills pending in the legislature, but no presumptive causation. Same thing in North Carolina. In North Dakota, you have a governor taking action, Governor Doug Burgum, but really he may as well have not done much at all. Through an executive order on March 25th, Governor Burgum decreed that there would be workers' compensation benefits for first responders who suffer from COVID-19, but only during quarantine and for a maximum of 14 days. Any other claim would require first responders to prove that the infection resulted from a work-related exposure. So again, he really didn't do much at all. Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, There is no presumptive causation in any of those states. Pennsylvania looked like nothing was going to happen. And then on April 30, the legislature really got its act together, passed what's known as Act 17. And that created a conclusive presumption that a enforcement officer's COVID-19 was caused by the job. Probably firefighters already benefited from a presumptive causation that's differently written. And Governor Tom Wolf signed that into law immediately. Rhode Island, we have a statement from the governor. Governor Gina Raimondo announced that first responders who get coronavirus can now be eligible for workers' compensation, but I can't find that an executive order has been issued, and there's no legislation that is pending. South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, nothing going on in any of those states. Texas, Governor Greg Abbott suspended on March 30 two sections of the Texas Labor Code during the pandemic, essentially creating a conclusive presumption for first responders who were seeking medical reimbursements during the pandemic. So again, just medical costs, not any sort of disability costs or death benefits or anything like that. So it's a partial presumptive causation. By the way, I've reached out to several lawyers that I'm friends with in Texas and asked them, can a governor suspend statutes, the Texas Labor Code? And their answer is probably under Texas, the emergency laws in Texas. Utah, on April 13th, the legislature approved House Bill 3007 that established a presumptive causation. Vermont already had presumptive causation in the law only for firefighters. It's from any infectious conditions. No attempt to expand that to other first responders. Virginia, no presumptive causation. Washington, another governor, has announced, this is Governor Jay Inslee, announced an emergency rule that the State Department of Labor and Industries will pay wage loss and medical treatment expenses for first responders who are quarantined or who contract COVID-19 after being exposed on the job. West Virginia, no legislative action. On April 15th in Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers signed Assembly Bill 1038, a COVID-19 presumption. However, because of last-minute amendments, you may remember in Wisconsin, you've got this situation where you have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature, and they don't get along very well. So what happened was Governor Evers was supporting a broad presumptive causation. The legislature, in some last-minute amendments to an omnibus COVID-19 bill, said, yeah, we're kind of sort of going to have presumptive causation, but the employee has to prove that they had contact with an individual who tested positive for COVID-19 in order to benefit from the presumption. The police unions in particular in Wisconsin got very, very angry about that and condemned what it was the legislature did. Governor Evers announced support for corrective legislation, but the legislature isn't scheduled to meet for the remainder of the year. And then lastly, Wyoming. We're on state number 50. Thank heavens, we're on state number 50. And it is the most recent state to act on May 17th. The legislature passed Bill 1002 that provides that first responders have sort of a limited presumption. And it is the presumption that the risk of contracting COVID-19 was increased by the nature of their employment. So if you're counting, and some of you are, we have 10 executive orders signed by governors that establish a real live presumptive causation. No, I'm not counting North Dakota. So we have 10 of those. And on your scorecard, two of them came from Republican governors, eight of them came from Democratic governors. In terms of the states that have, where the legislatures have enacted presumptive causation, those are roughly evenly split between Republican-dominated states and Democratic-dominated states. Next up, what is going on with hazardous duty pay? Well, it's on a real catch-as-catch-can basis. It seems like there's no overwhelming movement around the country towards hazardous duty pay. And you've seen a lot of debates in legislatures about should we do this. There doesn't seem to be that much of an opposition to doing it for first responders. But then people get into the issue of drawing lines. If you're going to do it for first responders, shouldn't you have to do it for healthcare workers? And if you are going to do it for healthcare workers, what about the other people that are compelled to work? What about those people, for example, in the meat processing facilities? Should they get hazardous duty pay? And if you start talking about all of those folks, doesn't it get incredibly expensive? And I think that's what's been going on in legislatures. You do see it on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis, but I do not know of a state where it has been adopted on a statewide basis. And if it is adopted, it'll be interesting to see what the funding mechanism is, whether or not it's going to be funded by the state government that mandates it, or whether cities and counties will be obligated to fund it on their own. The federal government is thinking about it. You may have seen that we are now up to our fifth Coronavirus Relief Act. Four have passed. The fifth is pending in Congress right now. It has passed the House of Representatives, and it would create what's labeled as a Heroes Fund. And the Heroes Fund would do essentially two things. First of all, it would provide a pandemic premium pay increase for essential frontline workers, and that would include first responders. How much? $13 an hour from the start of the emergency, so it would be retroactive through December 31 of 2020. And secondly, it would create a $15,000 recruitment incentive for health and home care workers and first responders who hire onto the job to try to, in the words of the Democratic National Committee that came up with this, to attract and secure the workforce needed to fight the public health crisis. So this passed the House on May 15th. It now goes over to the Senate. You may have noticed that the House and the Senate aren't playing well together. And in particular, the leaders of those two, Nancy Pelosi in the House, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, don't seem to play well together. Mitch McConnell refused to bring the Senate back into session before Memorial Day to address this bill that the House passed, the fifth Coronavirus Relief Act that would contain the Heroes Fund. And right now, we don't know the status of this bill, nor the notion of a Heroes Fund or whatever it is called on the federal level. We won't know it until, I think, the Senate comes back into session, whenever the Senate President O'Connell calls them back into session. On hazard duty pay, we have a great big what if. The same thing, I think, is true with respect to bargaining as to what's going on around the country. We're seeing very, very few settlements. Normally, this time of year, when we have the July 1 fiscal year that many cities and counties are on approaching, we'd be seeing reports of multiple public safety wage settlements around the country every day. We set up news trawlers, searches where we try to come up with newspaper articles that detail settlements. And normally, you know, we might be seeing 3 to 5, maybe even as many as 10 settlements a day come in this time of the year. And now we're going days without seeing any sign of a settlement. And from what I hear from talking with people on both sides of the table, employers are just way too jittery right now to be seriously thinking about settling long-term contracts. There's some exceptions, but most employers are thinking, you know, look, we can't settle anything as to what's going to happen immediately. Don't even think about talking to us about a year or two or three, because it's just simply unpredictable. We don't know how serious and how permanent the holes in our revenue structures are going to be. Where we are seeing settlements, I have to say that probably the predominant form of a settlement is a modified rollover or extension. So what do I mean by that? So let's say you've got a contract that is due to expire not in 2020, but June 30, 2021. And so you have a wage increase that would be coming on July 1, a pre-negotiated wage increase. Say it's a 5% wage increase. What we are seeing are the unions and the employers agreeing to one of two variations on the same theme. Variation number one doesn't extend the contract, but it moves that wage increase from July 1 of 2020 to some point in 2021. And it could be the last day of the fiscal year. It could be June 30, 2021. So it rolls up into the base for the next year. It could be January 1, 2021. I've seen one contract where the parties are obligated to meet and confer once a quarter, starting July 1, 2020, as to when that raise is going to be implemented. They'll take a look at the budget on each occasion. So that's one version, and that is you simply move that wage increase so it doesn't have the immediate impact on the employer. The second version is you do the same thing, only you extend the contract for 1 year. And instead of moving that wage increase into the fiscal year 2019-2020, you move it into the fiscal year instead of moving it from fiscal year 2020 to 2021, you move it to fiscal year 2021 to 2022. So that would mean that instead of that wage increase being paid July 1, 2020, might come into effect July 1, 2021. Or January 1, 2022. And so the theme of all of this is the same. Let's put off the cost as much as we can without disturbing the essential benefit of the bargain. And again, if I had to pick a predominant way you see these settlements, that would be it. There are some where you see just, you know, some flat-out wage increases. There are some where you see some wage freezes. I haven't seen a wage reduction yet. I've seen a lot of talk about them, but I haven't seen one. But when I talk about something being predominant, keep in mind we don't have a rich data set yet because not that many people are actually negotiating contracts right now. All right. Last thing I want to talk about is this law enforcement issue of whether or not officers have the discretion or the right to not enforce aspects of a lockdown policy that is decreed by the legislature. We get calls in our office from our clients asking questions about that. My law partner, Anil Karia, has actually had to be on the phone with individual officers trying to convince them that they have an obligation to enforce these lockdown orders if their employers are saying you have an obligation to enforce these lockdown orders. And yet, the message does not seem to be getting across nationally. I just read a news article yesterday from a television station in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, a big city, about, you know, almost, I think, maybe even more than a million people. It's a big city. And the union in Columbus, the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, has publicly expressed a concern about officers complying with certain aspects of lockdown orders. And so I know I talked about this before, but I want to be very specific about it this time and actually give you a little bit from a controlling case on the whole issue. Can officers say, no, I'm not going to enforce those laws because I don't think they're constitutional? And the answer to me is absolutely no. They cannot. Well, they can say that. But if their employer says, you are ordered to enforce these laws, and the officer says, I am not going to do so, that's insubordination. And that is a potential termination offense. The rule is that police officers, law enforcement officers in this country, don't get to decide the constitutionality of laws, whether those laws are statutes or whether those laws are executive orders. They don't get to decide that. That is the province of the courts. And officers act at their risk if they make the decision to either enforce or not enforce a law because of their personal beliefs. And that risk is a serious risk. It's the risk of losing your job because of the offense of insubordination. So why am I so strident about this? Why do I think this is such a big deal? And the reason I think it's a big deal is I really worry that we are going to lose some very good police officers to the mistaken belief that they can make individual judgments as to whether or not to enforce certain laws. What do the cases say about all that? And I don't want to be in the position where you think I'm just coming up with this off the top of my head. Well, we don't have any lockdown order cases because, of course, we've never had a lockdown order like this. This is relatively unprecedented. But we do have some religion cases. And I think we could probably all agree that a bona fide, fervently held religious belief is clearly constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of religion. And that constitutional protection is going to be a higher constitutional protection than an officer thinking, you know, I don't believe the Constitution allows for a lockdown order. That religious belief is clearly articulated as entitled to protection under the First Amendment, where that general political belief, I don't have to enforce that because that rule's unconstitutional, that's not as clearly protected. And the reason I make that point is because these religion cases, I think, show you the apex, the high point of an officer being able to say, I'm not going to enforce that law. And you know what? That high point doesn't exist. So let me talk about three cases here, okay? The first one involved a state trooper who refused an assignment to investigate crimes at a casino. This is one of these river casinos that is out there, and it's a case, if I recall correctly, that came out of Illinois, one of those riverboat casinos. Why did the trooper not want to take this assignment to investigate crimes at the casino? because he thought that would involve the facilitation of gambling, and that violated his religious beliefs. The employer said, "We're not going to accommodate your request to get a different assignment. We're ordering you to work that casino detail." The trooper refused and was fired. And the trooper then brought a religious discrimination suit. And that case went up to a federal court of appeals, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which some would argue, and I would be on that list, maybe the best federal court in the country, has been for many years because of the quality of the judges on the court. Leans conservative, leans pro-employer on labor cases, but there is no assailing the relative genius of some of those judges on the court, the likes of Frank Easterbrook and the now retired Richard Posner. Anyway, I could go on for a long time. And boy, I tell you, those guys and gals can write. Best written of federal court opinions in the country come out of the Seventh Circuit. So what did the Seventh Circuit do with this trooper's case? It upheld the trooper's discharge. And I want to read you three or four sentences out of the court's opinion that will give you a flavor for what the court's logic was. And I'm quoting, "Many officers have religious scruples about particular activities. To give just a few examples, Baptists oppose liquor as well as gambling. Roman Catholics oppose abortion. Jews and Muslims oppose the consumption of pork. And a few faiths include hallucinogenic drugs in their worship and thus oppose legal prohibitions of those drugs. If the trooper is right, all of these faiths and more must be accommodated by assigning believers to duties compatible with their principles. Does the law require the state police to assign Unitarians to guard the abortion clinic, Catholics to prevent thefts from liquor stores, and Baptists to investigate claims that supermarkets misweigh bacon and shellfish? Must prostitutes be left exposed to slavery or murder at the hands of pimps because protecting them from crime would encourage them to ply their trade and thus offend almost every religious faith?" I told you, the Seventh Circuit can write, right? So you see the principle here. We can't have law enforcement officers picking and choosing which laws they are going to enforce. That's simply not our system. Second case was a very similar one. This is one involving an FBI agent who claimed a right on religious grounds to not work any assignment concerning nonviolent opposition to military activities. And the court said, you don't get to pick what your assignments are based upon your religion. And now let's go back for the third case. Let's go back to the Seventh Circuit. And this is a police officer, a Roman Catholic Chicago police officer, who refused to protect abortion clinics. Now, this is not the majority opinion. The majority opinion in the case upheld the discipline of the police officer. This is what's known as a concurring opinion. And what is a concurring opinion? I know the lawyers here will know, but it may be a bit of a mystery to non-lawyers. A concurring opinion means the judge agrees with the disposition of the case, disagrees with the bottom line, who won, who lost. But in the concurring opinion, the judge may say, in addition to everything they said, I got this to say. Or may say, I agree with the bottom line, but all of their logic is wrong, and this is the way it should have come out. So that's what a concurring opinion is. A dissenting opinion is one where the judge says, I disagree with the bottom line as to how it came out. And sometimes, of course, you can have judges who write opinions that are concurring in part and dissenting in part, and it gets dizzying at times. But I love the concurring opinion in this case because of the way it echoes the Bacon misweighing comments of the Seventh Circuit. I'm quoting, "Public protectors such as police and firefighters must be neutral in providing their services. The public knows that its protectors have a private agenda. Everyone does. But it would like to think that they leave that agenda at home when they are on duty. They would like to think that Jewish policemen protect neo-Nazi demonstrators, that Roman Catholic policemen protect abortion clinics, that black Muslim policemen protect Christians and Jews, that fundamentalist Christian policemen protect noisy atheists and white-hating Rastafarians, that Mormon policemen protect Scientologists, and that Greek Orthodox policemen of Serbian ethnicity protect Roman Catholic Croats. We judges certainly want to think that U.S. Marshals protect us from assaults and threats without regard to whether, for example, we vote for or against the pro-life position in abortion cases." So these courts are all saying the same thing. And there's other opinions. I just wanted to focus on those three. They're saying law enforcement employees don't get to choose which laws they are going to enforce. If their employers order them to enforce the law, they've got to do it. And it is up to a court to hold that a particular law is illegal. The last thing I want to do is I want to venture into an area that I know virtually nothing about. Those of you who've known me for a while know that that's virtually no restraint at all. And I want to talk about whether or not these lockdown orders are legal. Kind of the underlying principle. So if you can't convince an employee you've got to comply with the employer's order and your individual political beliefs on this don't matter, if you can't convince them of that, maybe you can convince them that the lockdown orders are legal. Because there is Supreme Court law that goes back more than 200 years establishing that these sorts of orders are legal. I'm going to focus on only one case. It's 100 years old, and it's a case involving the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And what the Commonwealth was doing was requiring vaccination. This was a mandatory vaccination law. Now, again, if like with the religious cases, if you think about it, mandatory vaccination, that's going to be kind of at a higher level of protection than would be simply complying with a lockdown order or being forced to wear a mask. If you're being forced to take medicine, you're going to have more rights there, right, than you would be if you were being told, look, you can't go out to your local bar or you have to stay home unless you have certain reasons for staying home. I think we can all agree that compelled medical treatment is going to have a high level of protection. And the Supreme Court in this case, and we'll post it on our website, it's a case called Jacobson versus Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Supreme Court held that the mandatory vaccination laws were constitutional. And I'm going to read you about four or five sentences here from the court's majority opinion. This was written by one of our longest serving Supreme Court judges, the first Justice John Harlan. And here's what he had to say. "The liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States to every person within its jurisdiction does not import an absolute right in each person to be at all times and in all circumstances wholly freed from restraint. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. on any other basis, organized society could not exist with safety to its members. Society based on the rule that each one is a law unto himself would soon be confronted with disorder and anarchy. Real liberty for all could not exist under the operation of a principle which recognizes the right of each individual person to use his own, whether in respect of his person or his property, regardless of the injury that may be done to others. And he went on and on. The opinions back then, by the way, 100 years ago, were about, 10 to 20% as long as the opinions are today. And so when I say he went on, it's relative. It's a pretty short opinion. And the Supreme Court has said that on multiple occasions. And, if you think about it, isn't that at the heart of the Japanese internment litigation? When Japanese Americans were interned in the early 1940s, they were basically taken out of their homes, their property, either confiscated or left for, to be picked apart by vandals. And they were placed in an internment facility, aka a prison. And they had committed no crime and done nothing wrong. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Korematsu, upheld that. Now, there's been a lot of subsequent criticism of the Korematsu case. And that is a pretty, that's more than the lockdown, right? That's taking you and locking you up instead of locking you down in your own house. So at any rate, bottom line here, these lockdown orders are almost certainly constitutional. And even if they weren't, police officers would be acting at the risk of their jobs if they did not enforce those laws and rules in the absence of a court holding them unconstitutional. Okay, that's it for our latest COVID-19 podcast. May it be our last, right? Hopefully, the trend that we are on is a positive trend. Hopefully, the easing of the lockdown regulations doesn't give us a spike in COVID-19. And hopefully, by the end of the summer, we're back to somewhat normal. Hey, all of you out there, stay well. This is Will Aitchison signing off.